KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, we hear from the CEO of the Port of Long Beach. He says time is running out to avoid major disruptions due to President Trump's tariff regime.
If you're looking to getting a product in July, you have to start making this order now. So I think the inflection point here is now in the next 30 days.
And hip-hop megastar Sean Diddy Combs goes on trial this week for charges of sex trafficking. Plus, the director of the new Nicolas Cage movie, The Surfer, talks about how the film is not your typical beach movie. It's Sunday, May 4th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump had a wide-ranging interview with NBC News' Meet the Press that's being aired in full today. He was asked by Kristen Welker if he will abide by the courts on the rights of migrants.
Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says
I don't know. It might say that.
Last month, the Supreme Court temporarily barred the Trump administration from deporting some suspected gang members from Venezuela. His lawyers are asking the court to lift or narrow that order. Warren Buffett had a surprise yesterday for the tens of thousands of people who came to Omaha, Nebraska for the annual shareholder meeting of his company, Berkshire Hathaway. He's stepping down at the end of the year. NPR's Maria Aspen has more.
Way past the retirement age is kind of an understatement. He's 94 years old. And look, there have been signs that he's been working towards this. His longtime business partner, Charlie Munger, died a couple of years ago. And Buffett had already announced that one of his deputies, Greg Abel, would eventually succeed him. But Buffett has still been the public face of his company. He spent nearly 5 hours yesterday answering questions from his investors in public.
NPR's Maria Aspen. The Vatican says preparations are nearing completion for the papal conclave, set to begin Wednesday. NPR's Jason DeRose reports cardinals are meeting now to discuss the issues facing the church.
Cardinals from around the world have been convening in what are called congregations. The Vatican press office says several themes have emerged from those meetings, including how the Catholic Church and the Pope promote peace, how the next leader will need to address sexual abuse, and how the next pope should be prophetic so that, quote, the church will not shut itself in the upper room, but go out and bring light to a world desperately in need of hope. The Vatican says cardinals understand that without addressing these concerns, the church is in danger of becoming what it calls insignificant. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
Israeli authorities are vowing retaliation after a missile attack this morning. Houthi rebels based in Yemen have claimed responsibility. The missile landed near Ben-Gurion Airport, Israel's main international airport, causing panic in the terminal and briefly halting flights. Houthi rebels have been launching attacks against Israel to show solidarity with the Palestinians since the war in Gaza erupted in October 2023. Police in London say they've arrested 8 men suspected of plotting terrorist attacks in 2 separate investigations. They say 7 of the 8 suspects are Iranians. The nationality of the 8th has not yet been released. Officials have also not disclosed their targets. This is NPR News. Almost 6 months after the November election, there's still one major statewide race that has not been called. It's for a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Republican candidate Jefferson Griffin is trying to have thousands of ballots thrown out in hopes of erasing the lead held by the Democratic incumbent. Steve Harrison of member station WFAE reports.
North Carolina's Republican-controlled state Supreme Court last month opened the door for Jefferson Griffin to win the race against Allison Riggs by requiring thousands of overseas and military voters in a handful of Democratic-leaning counties to provide photo ID or have their ballots thrown out. A federal court has stopped that ID requirement for now, and the election dispute is now in the hands of a U.S. District Court judge. Meanwhile, Republicans this week took control of the State Board of Elections after a court okayed a law that shifted appointment power away from the state's Democratic governor. It's possible the new GOP-controlled elections board could give Griffin favorable rulings. For NPR News, I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte.
Happy Star Wars Day to those who celebrate. It was created by fans of the movie on May the 4th in honor of May the Force Be With You. Disney, which acquired the franchise in 2012, marks the day to promote its merchandise. Although not an official holiday, former President Joe Biden celebrated a day early last year by welcoming Star Wars actor Mark Hamill to the White House. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Major ports up and down the West Coast are bracing for the full impact of the Trump administration's tariffs. The number of ships arriving is expected to drop dramatically, and the effect will be especially striking in Southern California. Los Angeles and Long Beach are the country's two busiest ports, processing around a third of all cargo containers arriving from overseas, a huge number of them from China. Joining us now is Mario Cordero, CEO of the Port of Long Beach. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me here, Aisha.
So can you give us a sense of what's happening right now with your port?
Well, I think the story of the day for the Port of Long Beach is we're starting to see less vessel arrivals, which means less cargo. And of course, that translates to potentially less jobs and an impact to consumers. In other words, they may not have their products in a couple months unless things change.
And so, I mean, how much of a drop are you seeing right now?
Well, right now, the first drop that we're seeing actually is going to be here in the month of May. Keep in mind that for the first quarter 2025, that is January through March, the Port of Long Beach moved more container cargo than any other port in the country. So we were certainly on a very high volume movement. April was decent, but now May, we're going to start seeing reduction. For the second half of 2025, we're looking to at least a 20% reduction in volume.
And how do you know that? Is it because of like contracts, or are these things planned out way in advance?
Well, there's two metrics that give you an indication. One, the diminished bookings that are coming out of Asia. There are importers now here in the USA that are not calling for orders from Asia. They're waiting on the sideline to see where this tariff number falls or more clarity, because right now there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what that tariff number will be at the end of the day. Number two, as of right now, our numbers through the month of June indicate that the carriers have had 34 blank sailings. What that basically means, 34 less vessels that are coming into the port complex.
And what impact does this have on the wider port economy?
Unless things change, you are going to have an impact in terms of job reduction across the supply chain, whether it's dock workers here at the port, truck drivers, people who work in the warehouses, and overall in the logistics supply chain. So we already have seen what that is in the COVID-19 crisis. If you recall, when during the COVID years, particularly in the latter part of 2020, 2021, everything came to a stop, so to speak.
Those supply chain disruptions during COVID led to higher prices. And then there were also concerns about like Christmas presents and stuff like that, whether you would just be able to get basic supplies. Is that something that could happen this time around?
There is a potential of that occurring. So let me give you an example. In this industry, when we talk about peak season, that is the time of year where cargo really comes in at higher numbers. Every year, annually, that starts around July. And the reason is because from July to August, you're looking to advance products coming into the country in preparation for the back-to-school spending and the holiday spending. Beginning July, that's going to be critical, because if you're a shipper and you're importing holiday type of products or even back to school, are you going to be paying 10% or are you going to be paying 46% of the tariffs, or in the case if it's from China, 145%? It's a scenario right now that time's ticking, so to speak, to get clarity and remove uncertainty. And I think that's all the business sectors are asking for at this point.
So the Trump administration is saying it wants to do a deal with China. If that happens, do you think that there will be a lasting impact of these tariffs? Or if they come out with a deal, will everything kind of just get back to normal?
Well, number one, we've been living in a tariff environment. If you recall, in the first Trump administration, there was an implementation of tariffs. The Biden administration basically followed that. I think the question now is, the percentiles that we're talking about are sometimes prohibitive, specifically the smaller shipper, the mid-sized shipper, and even the larger beneficial cargo owner. And you're starting seeing every day you listen to the news, CEOs of major companies are concerned. Some of the bigger players in terms of shipments, they're looking to perhaps a $100 million to a $300 million additional cost on products. And that's concerning because it's going to get passed down to the consumer. So if you get an example of a Nike shoe, so to speak, that shoe that could cost you $125 can now be at least $165.
You said the time is ticking. Is there a time by which you think that companies need these tariffs, whatever deal is going to be made, to be made, so they have that clarity? Like, is it by July? Is it by June? When does this need to be done?
Actually, the month of May is very key, because when you start booking shipments of products, you do that 2 months in anticipation. So if you're looking to getting a product in July, you have to start making this order now. So I think the inflection point here is now in the next 30 days.
That's Mario Cordero, CEO of the Port of Long Beach. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Sean Diddy Combs is going on trial in federal court. It's scheduled to start this week in Lower Manhattan. He's charged with sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. He's pleaded not guilty. Combs has used many different names through his career: Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, Love, Puffy, and just Diddy. But he's remained one of the most notable and powerful figures in hip-hop since the mid-1990s. Many in the music industry and hip-hop at large will be paying close attention to his trial. NPR Music's Rodney Carmichael has been following the case and Combs' career and joins us now. Hi, Rodney.
Hey, Aisha.
Before we get into the allegations against Sean Combs, and a warning, these allegations are disturbing. Tell us about the impact that he's had on hip-hop and pop culture up until now.
Well, really, Aisha, more than any music mogul of the last 30 years, Diddy, he's really responsible for making hip-hop pop. I mean, he brought champagne to the campaign. He dressed grimy East Coast rap up in shiny suits. Then, you know, there's the roster of talent he turned into stars as the producer. I'm talking Mary J. Blige, Biggie, Mace, Faith Evans, The Lox, 112, on and on and on. More than any one brand that he built, from Bad Boy Records to Sean John Clothing to Ciroc liquor deals and even Revolt TV, Diddy really mastered the art of reinvention. He made Can't Stop, Won't Stop, the hustle metric that all of hip-hop aspired to. And he really came to define this ideal of black excellence for the hip-hop generation.
But this indictment argues that his image and his empire is exactly what allowed Combs to operate with impunity for so many years. So what are the accusations at the heart of this case?
Well, this federal case, it alleges that he used his money, his power, and his entire business empire as a criminal enterprise to carry out and cover up a habitual pattern of sex crimes, including trafficking women across state lines to engage in commercial sex acts. And this case goes back as far as 2008 in terms of the incidents that it covers. It also alleges that he conspired with his own employees, security staff, and personal assistants to facilitate extended sex acts that he called freak-offs. Now, that was sometimes secretly filmed, and that drugs, violence, career promises, and threats, and other forms of coercion were used to lure, intimidate, and even force non-consenting female victims into having sex with male sex workers.
So these allegations go back years. Why is he coming to trial now?
So the federal case came together in the months following a civil suit filed by Combs's former artist and longtime partner, Cassie Ventura, in November 2023. Now, Ventura's lawsuit, it includes allegations that were later corroborated by the release of some really horrific hotel surveillance footage from 2016 that showed Combs kicking and dragging Ventura back into their suite after she had tried to escape. Now, he quickly settled that suit with Ventura a day after it was filed, but not before it opened the floodgates for what now amounts to more than 60 civil suits filed against him by women and men, all alleging various forms of sexual, physical, or emotional abuse, assault, or rape.
What will you be watching for as the trial begins this week?
Well, I think the main thing that a lot of people will be watching for is who will be called to the witness stand against Sean Combs. Like we've said, he's a powerful figure, and federal prosecutors have already said four accusers will testify, but they remain unnamed for now.
Do you think this trial could be the beginning of a Me Too reckoning in hip-hop?
Yeah, that's the real question. And honestly, I think there's a bit of a reluctance within hip hop to view his case and all the allegations of sexual abuse he's facing as a product of hip hop. I mean, the more these lawsuits have piled up, along with the disturbing video footage, details about the drug-induced sex acts, and the suggestion of homosexual acts, the easier it's become for men in hip-hop to distance themselves from what Sean Combs is accused of. I mean, look, hip-hop is guilty of espousing a lot of shameful and misogynistic treatment of women. And artists in the industry have always really defended it as just music. But Combs' alleged crimes, to the extent that they're true, have been happening in real life for years behind all the gloss and sheen of his public image. I mean, clearly it's an indictment of Sean Combs' character. Whether hip-hop, by and large, will accept it as a cultural indictment, that remains to be seen.
That's NPR Music's Rodney Carmichael. Thank you so much for getting us up to speed on this.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. In remarks aired today, Russian President Vladimir Putin said he hoped there would be no need to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. He still tells state television that Russia has significant strength and resources to take the war to what he called its logical conclusion. Voters in Romania are casting ballots today in a presidential election. The polls indicate a hard right candidate is leading. George Simion opposes military aid to Ukraine. And the South Texas home of SpaceX is now its own city. Elon Musk had sought the designation for his rocket company. It was overwhelmingly approved by voters yesterday. Most of the eligible voters are believed to work for SpaceX. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The 2024 election is still not over in North Carolina. 6 months after polls closed, there's an ongoing dispute over who won a seat on the state Supreme Court. Right now, the court leans Republican, and those seats are highly coveted by both parties because of big decisions the court makes, like over abortion or gerrymandering. Joining me now to talk about this is Steve Harrison from member station WFAE in Charlotte. Good morning.
Good morning, Aisha.
Steve, it's been almost half a year since the election. What in the world is going on in North Carolina?
Great question. There's a whole lot to explain here. Let's go back to election night. That night, the Republican in the race, Jefferson Griffin, was about 10,000 votes ahead of the Democrat in the race. That is Justice Allison Riggs, who is currently on the court. But over the next 2 weeks, as more mail ballots and provisional ballots came in, Riggs came out with a tiny lead, 734 votes out of more than 5.5 million cast.
Okay, so how did Griffin respond?
He moved to have more than 65,000 ballots thrown out. There were three buckets of challenged voters, and we're going to focus on the largest two groups. He says more than 60,000 voter registrations weren't complete, missing a driver's license number, for instance. He also challenged the ballots of roughly 5,500 military and overseas voters from a handful of Democratic-leaning counties because they didn't provide photo ID when casting their ballots. That's even though before and after the election, Republicans on the elections board agreed that these voters didn't need to show photo ID.
Okay, so more than 65,000 challenged voters. North Carolina's Republican-leaning Supreme Court has weighed in. What did it say?
The state's highest court said those 60,000 voters whose ballots allegedly have incomplete registrations should be counted. That's a win for Riggs. But, and this is a really big but, the court kept the door open for Griffin to erase his deficit. The court said the challenged overseas and military voters from those Democratic-leaning counties have 30 days to provide a photo ID or their ballots would be tossed. But for now, a federal court has blocked the North Carolina Supreme Court's ruling from going into effect.
Okay, so Steve, the case is on pause. I want to go back to the North Carolina Supreme Court ruling. It said overseas and military voters have to show a photo ID, but only from this handful of Democratic counties?
That's exactly right. And there are two justices on the court who don't think that's fair. One Republican justice, Richard Dietz, dissented and said he was surprised the court would rewrite election law after the election. And Democrat Anita Earls wrote that, quote, some would call it stealing the election. Others might call it a bloodless coup.
This fight has dragged on for 6 months, presumably costing a lot of money and legal fees. Regardless of what happens, the Republicans still control the high court. So why all the fuss?
Yeah, I spoke with one former justice on the state's highest court. His name is Bob Orr, and he was a conservative who served for a decade ending in 2004. But he left the Republican Party during the Trump era. He thinks the Trump campaign and the GOP were prepared with similar ballot challenges if Trump narrowly lost North Carolina. He won comfortably. So Orr says,
there was nothing to lose to see if they could not just flip this one particular Supreme Court seat, but make some law that would be favorable to their efforts going forward in future elections.
Griffin's consultant, Paul Shoemaker, said that's not right. He said he and Griffin chose his legal team and Orr is pushing a conspiracy theory. And just one more wrinkle, the Republicans took control of the State Board of Elections on Thursday after a long-running power fight between the governor, who is a Democrat, and the GOP. That could help Griffin throw out enough ballots for him to win.
That's Steve Harrison from member station WFAE. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dear William N. Powell,
like millions of other American college students, Liam Powell is about to graduate and start his working life. As a global health major who interned at the United States Agency for International Development, he eyed a postgrad internship at the State Department. He applied and got chosen, then came a hiring freeze.
The department hereby rescinds your tentative offer to participate in the student internship program.
Now, Liam Powell is headed home from his time at Duke Kushan University in China with a degree but no work in his field of choice. Alyssa Johnson planned to pursue a doctorate in ecology after her 4 years at Purdue.
Graduate admissions across the whole entire country have gone to a very low point because universities and institutions and professors need to protect the people they already have.
And that's forced her to reconsider. The past few months have upended life for many graduating seniors. The White House has accused schools like Columbia or Harvard of bias. The administration has voided federal contracts and frozen research money. Bobby McAlpine is the outgoing student body president at Ohio State.
One of the biggest things that I've heard from students have come to me and just, they feel really scared. I just think that people think that a lot of, or some of their government, people are making decisions in their name without actually consulting them.
Do you have some students, though, who are happy with the changes they're seeing?
There are people on all sides of the spectrum all the time. I delivered, I can't even count, probably over about 400 letters to the governor of Ohio, asking him to veto a bill, Senate Bill 1. 400 student letters from conservative students. It was from liberal students, from black students, white students. That did pass, and it's very unfortunate, but we'll continue to move forward.
And what did that piece of legislation do?
Yeah, Senate Bill 1, unfortunately, it gets rid of all offices of diversity and inclusion in all public university spaces within the state of Ohio. The only and sole reason why I am at The Ohio State University is because of our Office of Diversity and Inclusion. That's where I was able to go to make sure that I not only stayed in college, but I was able to stay afloat.
I would love to hear from the rest of you about how your post-graduation plans or even your immediate career goals have changed in the last few months. Alyssa?
So I have been researching how contaminants affect amphibians and their disease dynamics for the past 4 years. So I was going to continue that work. And I had applied to 3 different graduate schools for 3 different PhD programs. And one school, I had a tentative offer, and what ended up happening is I got waitlisted. The research that I was doing, there were some concerns about the funding source because it had both climate and diversity in the title. So
yeah, it's related to like diversity of the species.
Yeah, this is quite a strange thing that's going on with the National Science Foundation and like DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, is that they're using either people who maybe don't have a lot of expertise towards reviewing these grants and understanding like the scientific terms behind them, or they're using things like AI to screen through the names of grants for words like diversity, equity, climate change. And so with that, throughout the whole entire country, regardless of whether you're qualified or not, you're seeing, you know, either offers going out and then being rescinded, or, you know, everybody being put on some kind of wait list. And so that's kind of what ended up happening.
Well, Liam, what were you thinking as you were seeing the Trump administration essentially dismantling USAID?
There's a feeling that's pretty selfish of just knowing that the career field that I've spent so long studying for in my undergrad is just going to be in such a weird state of flux and toss-up for such a long time. I think that talking to a lot of professionals that work in the foreign aid and international development sector, there's a really common perspective that reform is absolutely necessary, but that this isn't the way to do it, and that this is a decision that objectively leads to the loss of a lot of lives in a way that a lot of the American public is very insulated from and just completely unaware of.
Bobby, you decided to push off law school for a year. Why did you decide to push it off?
Well, honestly, being so inundated in the fight for higher education this past year has quite frankly put a chill down my spine. I do want to be a lawyer. I do. I want to go to law school. But over this last few years, but especially this last semester, there is so much in flux right now. Why would I place myself in that extreme unknown rather than wait a few years to try and see just how this is going to affect everything?
Just from talking to other students, not even students that are American, but students that are coming to the U.S. to study, people are just so insanely worried and fearful about what's happening with ICE, with people being interrogated at the border, that sort of thing. And I think the worst part is that there isn't really anything that I can say as an American that would make the situation feel any sort of better, because the amount of uncertainty is just so profound. And I completely understand why a lot of people are really reevaluating whether they want to study in the U.S. or not, like a lot of my international friends.
A lot of this work, like research, have a lot of ties to the government. They're either government funded or a lot of people would go into the government. Is that something that you see in your future, or that you can see in your future now, doing research or going into government work for the federal government or what have you?
It's definitely not something for me that I've completely ruled out, and it's still a field that I'm really passionate about. So I think that it's more of a delaying of what my goals look like and where I want to be.
I would love to be a public servant if academia didn't work out for me. But I think the reality is that the shifts that are happening right now are making it incredibly difficult for that to happen. And like Liam was saying, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time. It takes decades to get these institutions set up. And usually once those things go private, or if they're shut down, they don't come back. And I wasn't very tapped into that until recently, because maybe this is ignorant of me, but I just felt like I didn't have to. It felt like the funding was always going to be there.
Honestly, Alyssa, that is exactly what so many students are feeling. Where we get our funding as a university, especially coming from a public university like I am, it never really crossed students' minds. At the end of the day, America in general has really, really leaned into the free pursuit of thought and free pursuit of academic excellence. And that's what makes people, just like Liam was saying, come from across the world just to have the opportunity to study in a place like the United States of America.
I think one thing that you said, Bobby, that I've really been trying to like promote within like my friends and the people that I interact with is like, you hear a lot of, I'm so overwhelmed right now. I feel so depressed. I feel so horrified by what's going on. I just don't know what to do. I'm just going to like delete Instagram, or I'm just going to delete my news apps. And I feel like one thing that like I've been trying to do, and that I feel like a lot of, you know, like young people are starting to shift towards, is this is so horrifying and it is so scary and it is so frustrating and it makes me so angry, but I can't look away.
Silence is not an option anymore.
And Liam, did you have anything you wanted to say?
I really think both Bobby and Alyssa have both put it together really well. I feel like a lot of the actions that are happening are sort of trying to isolate us and make us feel small, but that's really not the case, because we're all going through such similar things. We have to work together for, I don't know, for something better than this to happen. I just think that it's going to take me a few years longer than I expected to sort of realize my post-college dream, but I think that I'll get there eventually.
We've been talking with college seniors Bobby McAlpine, Alyssa Johnson, and Liam Powell. Congratulations to all of you. I'm wishing you all the best of luck. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been an awesome conversation.
Thank you for giving us a platform for our voices.
This segment was produced by Elena Twerk and Janet Ujong Lee. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Every year, venomous snake bites kill tens of thousands of people globally, and they permanently disable several hundred thousands more. Now a team says it's developed an anti-venom cocktail that works against a diverse collection of venomous snakes, using a process that it hopes could lead to a universal anti-venom. Here's NPR's Ari Daniel.
Most people try to avoid venomous snakes. Not Tim Frady.
My claim to fame is getting bit by snakes.
Frady used to hunt garter snakes growing up in Wisconsin. As an adult, his obsession turned to venomous snakes and the harm they cause people globally. He felt the most dramatic way to raise awareness of the issue was to allow himself to be bitten. Right out of the gate, though.
I was put in ICU after two cobra bites, and I dropped in a coma for 4 days.
He recovered and got more careful. Frady estimates he's now been bitten some 200 times. His motivation evolved to see if he could develop immunity to this swirl of toxins so that his body might provide a roadmap to making a broader kind of antivenom. For decades, antivenoms have come from the antibodies generated by animals like horses injected with venoms. But Jacob Glanville, the CEO of the biotech company Centivax, wanted to find a shared molecular site across multiple venom toxins from different snake species that he could target. And rather than using a horse, Glanville figured that a person who'd been repeatedly exposed to lots of different venoms might have antibodies directed against such a site.
I was calling vivariums, hoping for a clumsy snake researcher.
And then he found Tim Frady.
But we need your blood, we need your antibodies.
If anybody has broken through the problem of getting the immune system to focus, it's this guy, by this repeated stimulation with all these snakes.
I'm like, wow, cool.
So Glanville scanned Frady's blood, poring over the troves of antibodies to find those that bound the neurotoxins of multiple snakes.
And we found the ultra-broad antibody that had this very remarkable ability to go bind right on the conserved site that the neurotoxin uses to cause paralysis.
In mice, the antibody worked fully against five snakes, the black mamba and a mix of cobras. Next, Glanville and his colleagues added a small molecule that had already been shown to work against some venoms, and they went back to Frady's blood and found a second broad-acting antibody.
And that's when we suddenly saw this coherent protection that was happening across this large panel.
This cocktail of three components offered mice complete protection against 13 species and partial protection against six more, representing venomous snakes from Asia, Africa, Australia, North America, and more. There are other antivenoms that can neutralize a diverse set of snakes, but this is the first to do so using synthetic antibodies. The results are published in the journal Cell. David Williams is a scientist who evaluates antivenoms for the World Health Organization who wasn't involved in the research.
It's definitely a step in the right direction because it's answering some of the questions we have about how to properly design universal antibodies.
Williams cautions that further developing this cocktail into a truly universal antivenom will inevitably have its challenges, including doing human trials and expanding its coverage to vipers, which make up about half of venomous snakes. Meanwhile, when Tim Frady heard that his antibodies had helped create this new antivenom cocktail, he says he was happy.
When I do it, I know I'm doing something for humanity and getting back to science.
Frady is now director of herpetology at Centivax, where the team is planning to test their new cocktail in dogs that have been bit by venomous snakes in Australia. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Boarding domestic flights will look a little different soon. You'll have to show something called a real ID to get on a plane, but don't worry.
There is some good news here. There's some wiggle room built into the system because they knew that not everyone would be ready.
Everything you need to do about real ID. Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Houston police are investigating an early morning shootout that killed one person and wounded several others. Assistant Police Chief Patricia Cantu said it happened when an uninvited guest was asked to leave a family party and started shooting. Others returned fire. Jury selection begins tomorrow in New York in the federal criminal trial of Sean Diddy Combs. The music mogul is charged with sex trafficking and racketeering. And cardinals from around the world are gathering at the Vatican to select a new pope, the leader of the Catholic Church. The conclave begins Wednesday. The Vatican says preparations are nearing completion. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The Trump administration says it will stop paying out $1 billion in federal grants for schools. The money, approved by Congress, was meant to help districts across the country hire mental health workers. NPR's Corey Turner has a story of one of those districts and what they're about to lose.
Derek Fielkevich is superintendent of schools in Corbett, Oregon. Back in 2022, he was worried that the students in his largely rural district east of Portland were stressed and needed more mental health support.
We, at the time, had two counselors for the entire school district. Four buildings, 1,100 students, two counselors.
Then Congress passed the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, partly in response to the devastating elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. And part of that bill sent $1 billion, with a B, to schools to pay for 14,000 new mental health professionals. Corbett, Oregon, got enough to pay for five new social workers for 5 years.
Oh my gosh, it's been amazing.
Fielkevich says before, many students simply refused to ask for help because his two counselors were just too busy. But after the federal money came in and he more than tripled his mental health staff,
our social workers the entire day were meeting with students like a revolving door.
On Tuesday, Fielkevich and other superintendents who got these mental health grants received an email from the U.S. Department of Education.
If you give me 2 seconds, let me grab the letter.
It said his district's grant would not be lasting 5 years and instead would be discontinued after this year. Why?
So it says the department has undertaken a review of grants and determined that
the department tells NPR in a statement that the Biden administration encouraged districts in applying for the money to prioritize diversity. And that led some, the department says, to, quote, implement race-based actions like recruiting quotas in ways that have nothing to do with mental health. It provided NPR with a handful of excerpts from districts' grant applications, including one application that said school counselors must be trained, quote, to recognize and challenge systemic injustices, anti-racism, and the pervasiveness of white supremacy. All of this, the department argues,
violate the letter of purpose of federal civil rights law.
Superintendent Derek Fielkevich says now, with the money running out 2 years early,
it's horrible
because he likely won't be able to afford to keep those five social workers.
I feel for our students more than anything because they're not going to get the services that they need.
Last year, three Republican senators wrote an op-ed in which they explained why they voted for this money. Quote, "We crafted our law to ensure teachers and administrators are equipped with the tools to recognize when a student is experiencing a mental health crisis, and more importantly, connect them with the care they need before it's too late." Corey Turner, NPR News.
Here's an idea for a summer movie. take some pumped up beach bullies.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
I grew up here.
Don't live here. Don't surf here.
Throw in a dash of toxic masculinity. Add some sun-bleached insanity from Nicolas Cage.
Oh, Julie, the ride.
And you have The Surfer, the latest movie from Cage, who is, of course, the surfer. He's a father returning to a childhood beach in Australia with his son, but the locals known as the Bay Boys won't let them surf. The movie's director, Lorcan Finnegan, joined me recently, and I'll have him pick up the plot from there.
He, being a kind of father, feels that he's being disrespected by these guys. He did grow up there when he was a kid, so his son's embarrassed by him because he wasn't able to stand up to these guys. So his son leaves, but he returns by himself, and he stubbornly is going to stay there because he's also waiting for his mortgage broker to call and say that he will get the money to be able to buy back this childhood home that he grew up in. But gradually, he starts losing things bit by bit, his phone, his shoes, his wallet. He ends up kind of going into a sort of a fugue state where he doesn't really even know who he is anymore because of the heat of the Australian summer and all these people messing with him, whether they're gaslighting him or they're actually showing him who he really is.
Well, and what do you think about that? Because so much of the movie is about a real estate deal. Like, he wants to get his childhood home. You know, his wife is trying to divorce him. His son is, estranged, and he wants to buy it all back. He feels like getting this house, getting this property is going to fix it.
He thinks if he gets that, then that it'll have a ripple down effect and his wife will return to him and his son will love him and he can kind of relive his own childhood with this family. The course of this journey that helps him learn that it's actually not the material things that he needs and it's something more primal and simple. He just wants to go surfing with his son.
But is that part of what this movie is about? Is about stripping down the materialistic things and also like the idea of what masculinity has to look like and getting to the core of yourself?
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like a very extreme therapy that he goes through. And yeah, it does. It examines fatherhood. It examines masculinity in a way and how people can be drawn towards these very toxic kind of characters who are also very charming and charismatic, like the character Julie McMahon plays, Scally.
Scally, yes. He's the leader of the Bay Boys. He's almost like a cult leader, kind of. And, that idea of modern men, they're soft, and so they have to release their inner animal. What does Scally kind of represent?
Well, that section of society, you know, the kind of Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson, Tim Morrison kind of person. But he's a slightly ambiguous character as well, because I think from the audience perspective, it seems like he's trying to help Nick. Like, he doesn't have bad intentions, or maybe he does, you know, so he's kind of going along that line. There's also a little bit poking fun at that, you know, like boys not letting other boys play in their treehouse. You know, they've got this tiki hut down on the beach and they won't let him join the gang, you know. But of course, if you're told you can't join the gang, all you want to do is join the gang.
Is there something about surfing that transcends every day? Is there something about it that, is there an adventure there that you can't get elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think with this story, it was kind of baked into the this idea of the actual narrative, where like a wave forms over time and it builds.
Brewing and churning for days, weeks, months, sometimes even years. And it's all building to this breaking point. A short, sharp shock of violence on the shore. And you either surf it, or you get wiped out.
That, you know, that's the beginning of the film. He says that to his son, and then the rest of the story, you watch that happen, you know, in slow-mo. So there is something with surfing, though, that's like, it has a really interesting kind of culture, being part of the group of surfers who, particularly who kind of take ownership of certain waves or certain breaks on a beach, is it's kind of fascinating. It's fascinating to watch.
Well, and is, you know, every surf movie kind of has that, you know, surfing is life. Is it because it's like, you know, the idea that surfing is also, it's riding nature, right? Like, it's you're not fighting against it. you're learning how to conquer it, go with the flow. That's a lesson for life, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And be ready to go and be confident to go, because if you second guess yourself when you're about to kind of get on a wave, you'll crash, you know?
That's Lorcan Finnegan. He is the director of The Surfer. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The word florilegium comes from the Latin florilegus, meaning a gathering of flowers. It's also a word for a literary collection, an anthology. And now it's the title of singer-songwriter Uwede's debut album. A reflective, deeply personal collection of songs about memory, family, and growing into yourself. Rooted in her Nigerian-American identity, each song feels carefully chosen, curated to fit into the anthology of her life. Uwede joins us now to tell us more about her album. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
You were raised in North Carolina, but you were born in Nigeria. Do you feel like you have representations of both places on this album?
I definitely think so. Some of the songs, I think, are directly inspired by my Nigerian heritage. But then there's also some sort of more classic, like, folk-inspired stuff, which I definitely got a lot of when I was growing up in North Carolina.
Where are you right now? Are you outside? Are you on the street? Or
I'm outside of a coffee shop in Seattle, Washington, getting ready for my show. Just came from San Francisco this morning, landed at 9 a.m. It's a wild life I'm living at the moment.
Well, and I mean, I guess that makes thinking about home when you're on the road and all that even more complicated. What is home? Do you grapple with that on this album?
Definitely. I mean, it's such a big part of how I think about things. As of right now, just because I'm so close to my mom, I think of home as wherever she is. At this point, because I've had so many homes, at least conceptually or sort of based on my heritage, I feel like anywhere can be a home, and I think it's more about the people.
You have a song, The Place in the Sky, that seems to capture a lot of these feelings.
So whenever you're ready, I'll ask for you at the door.
And your singing is absolutely beautiful. Is there someone that you're singing to in the song?
Well, that song came after the passing of my father in 2020.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. Thank you. And in a way, I was singing to him. I was singing about him, but I was also just singing to God, singing to this sort of force beyond me. I see death as something that everyone will have to face at one point or another, and I think when you're grieving, you're particularly close to it.
When the poets welcome me, I know this is the place.
There's a sense of the past and present kind of constantly overlapping throughout the album. How did you think about the way time and memory intertwine?
As we know, there are certain things that happen to us in life. If you smell a certain perfume or if you hear a certain song, it's like it's happening all over again. And so in a way, I feel like time can be very flexible. And for me, I definitely like the idea of playing with time a little bit. So
the song Harmattan, what does that mean? Where does that title come from?
So it's the name of a weather season in West Africa. Dust comes from the Sahara and it covers almost all of West Africa. I would always visit Nigeria during that time when I was younger. And so I just thought Nigeria was always dusty and cloudy. For some reason, the chord progression that I started the song with really felt like that season to me.
We have a clip from the song, so let's play a little bit of that. Understand the drum beat is taken from a ritual that was used at your dad's funeral?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of rituals. There's this thing called Egbagbonelimi, and it's this dance that people do where my dad is from, and I've always loved it. I remember I got to watch them perform at my grandmother's funeral, then my dad's funeral, and it was just like I wanted to pay some homage to that in the drums.
Answer that question for yourself, that lyric, when will you decide, are you happy with your life?
You know, I thought I did. And you know what? I am right back there asking myself that same thing, both of those questions at this moment.
You talked about how your mom is also like home for you, and you included her voice on a song. Tell me about that.
It's called Amenagaon, which means the water you will drink. And it's from a larger proverb. My mom explained it to me, like, once you put your hand in the river, the water that's going to enter your cup or your jug, that's the water you were meant to have, and it won't pass you by. It won't be too late. It won't be too early. It'll be for you at the right time.
I mean, like, what is for you is for you. Can't nobody take it from you, right?
Exactly. And the first time she told me what that phrase meant, I was blown away. This is so comforting. I think in the wake of my father's passing, I really have realized how fragile life is.
That's Uwede. Her debut album, Florilegium, is out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.